For an even better way to listen to Football Weekly at home, at work or on the go, head to soundcloud.com/Guardian Football Weekly or download the SoundCloud app for Android and iPhone.
Football Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
You'll notice over the next 40 minutes or so that I'm not James Richardson, and nor am I that bloke off Soccer AM. At this point, I'm supposed to say something self-deprecating, but they're both off on suitably middle-class holidays, and I need the money. So you're stuck with me, Dave Farrar, described recently on Twitter as the bloke who does the ESPN commentaries and says all of the names in a pretentious Italian accent. So at least James and me have something in comune. We'll be looking back on the weekend's FA Cup action, including the surprise sight of a club out-shambling Blackburn, and ahead to that self-same club's attempts to deal with the might of Bayern Munich. Rafi Honigstein will be along to tell us whether Arsenal have a hope in hell. We'll talk to Sid Lowe as well about Barca, Real, Malaga and the bees in his music collection. I bet there's some Bauhaus and Blue Nile there. And don't switch off, there will be Europa League chat for which you've all been waiting. Woohoo with a capital W. Now, our Monday panel consists of Barry Glendenning, Simon Burnton and Paul McInnes, who, intriguingly, was meant to be at a rave in Peru, but has decided instead to sit here.
Aren't we all at a rave in Peru nowadays?
Is that the case?
Yeah, it's definitely.
Is it a state of mind thing?
It's pretty much de rigueur. It's one of these things that kind of they try to put little festivals on.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a successful one in Croatia, so somebody thinks, oh, I need to do it in another country now, so why not Peru? But I decided at my advanced years it might be better to stay in the office instead.
Okay, and it's an actual geographical thing. It's not just something in your head.
No? Yeah, it's an actual geographical thing, yeah. It's not a state of mind.
Peru, the country, rather than a nightclub of the same name.
Well, actually, I never went as far as to check that out, but I'm pretty sure it was the country. It's definitely involved.
So you're supposed to be at a rave in Peru, and Max Rushton is on holidays in Iceland, and James Richardson is skiing somewhere. I don't think the rest of us are getting paid enough.
Yeah, it's sort of the alternative reality a little bit of Football Weekly. We'll press on. And Simon, alternative reality-wise, you were doing sort of FA Cup updates at the weekend. Was it a thrilling FA Cup weekend? It was an odd weekend.
Well, it was a weekend of two halves, funnily enough. The Saturday was a kind of fun FA Cup day. There were some good results, some underdogs progressing. And then on Sunday, everyone who was supposed to win won with incredible comfort and ease.
Yeah, exactly. But you were doing Luton-Millwall, weren't you?
I was.
Luckily,
yeah.
Just football to talk about.
Yeah, Luton-Millwall. Well, indeed, just football to talk about. And it was a good game. And Luton was very unfortunate. Millwall had no chance at all in the first half, in which Luton played better than they did. But still, Millwall ended up 2-0 up at half time. So that was a bit rum, and there wasn't much coming back from that.
And Barry, if there's a major headline, I mean, I've written it down here, Wenger out, blah, 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 is what I've written. I mean, that's the headline from the weekend, isn't it? Kazim, as they called him in Turkey, so good they named him twice. I mean, was that a big shock, or is it just all too predictable now?
I don't think any poor Arsenal performance is ever a shock. The only thing they've been consistent with this season is their lack of consistency. Their supporters are complaining a lot, and because of the huge, the exorbitant ticket prices they have to pay, I suppose they're entitled to, but lots of teams don't win trophies for long periods, and it's not the end of the world. We were sort of discussing this before the pod. Some Arsenal supporters are emphatic that they want Wenger out, and they're sort of not necessarily going about it the right way, being kind of nasty about it. And others seem to think he should be given a chance. I don't see what the point of getting rid of him would be unless you have someone teed up to replace him with a new strategy for how the club might progress and win trophies. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
I mean,
or actually, no, it probably will be extremely tedious and boring to see what happens. It won't be interesting in any way at all.
That was the point. It's a hoary old debate. But just briefly, I mean, should he go or should he stay? What do you think, Paul?
I suspect, and it is a hoary old debate, I suspect it might be time for him to go, unfortunately, because the squad needs an almost entire overhaul. And it needs somebody to buy players that's going to improve the first team squad and the first 11 immediately, particularly in terms of the attitude and defensively too. And those appear to be the two things that Wenger been consistently getting wrong.
And this brilliant line from Michael Appleton, which I thought was the line of the weekend, talking about Shebby Singh. He's finally got Blackman going the right way, Simon. He said he hasn't been globally advising me, which I thought was just beautiful.
Yeah, well, Blackman are actually in danger of putting putting down their reputation for comedy, football club management. Since Appleton came in, they've been doing all right. They're marching up the championship. They're vaguely threatening to be in or around the playoff positions. I think they're eighth now, 6 points off the playoffs, but with Middlesbrough in pretty terrible form, there's certainly one place in that top six that's potentially available. I mean, it's not as if they outplayed Arsenal, but they're a team in good form, and perhaps Arsenal didn't take them as seriously as perhaps they should have done.
I mean, I think that's one thing about the FA Cup this season. You have seen a lot of top half sides not taking the cup very seriously, and it's almost indicative of where Man City are in the and their problems in the title race, that they took that game so seriously because they needed to give themselves a boost. But a lot of other teams, it's not important to them anymore.
Yeah, I just wonder about the careful for what you wish for thing with the FA Cup, Barry. I mean, France, I think, is a really good example. Calais got to the final famously and were, you know, dashed at the last by Nantes in that final. The French all bought into that as this great romantic story. And since then, a lot of lower league teams have got through to semis and indeed to finals as well without winning it. And the romance thing is almost dead. They want big teams in the final now. They're saying this tournament's devalued. Is the FA Cup in danger of going the same way? Do we go on about the romance too much?
Probably do. I mean, I don't think Arsenal can afford to be picky at this stage about what they're not good enough to win the league or the Champions League, or almost certainly not good enough. So, you know, the FA Cup and the Capital One Cup, as it's now called, are the only options open to them. So, and Wenger and Vermaelen have both admitted since the defeat against Blackburn that they were too complacent going into it, which I think was pretty obvious from looking at the match. And, you know, that's a regular occurrence on Arsenal's part, complacency. So when are they going to learn? I don't think that answered the question you actually asked me in any way.
No, but it's a point that you needed to make. Yeah. That's absolutely fine. Arsenal's complacency.
Glory matters to the fans, doesn't it? I mean, you definitely get that impression. But does it really matter so much to a club in terms of particularly a top half premiership side, in terms of the directors and the owners and the coaching staff? Because you don't get a Champions League place at the end of it. You get a Europa League place, which people don't generally tend to want. And it can be seen, although you can debate the statistical proof of this, it can be seen as a distraction from going on to qualify in the top four.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk on Thursday about the, Barry says, the Capital One Cup final, but there's so much romance talk about Bradford. I mean, rightly so, it's an incredible story. But when it comes down to it, I bet fewer people watch that than would watch a Manchester City-Manchester United final. I'm talking about neutrals, not just the huge fan base they've got.
Almost certainly. And it's sad, but true. I think possibly my favourite game of the season was the first leg of their semi-final against Aston Villa. That was just, I mean, incredible, an incredible match to watch and thrilling from first to last. Whether Sunday will match that, I'm really not sure. But certainly big teams make for big viewing figures. I'm sure that lots of people will decide that Sunday afternoon is a good time to go shopping.
Yeah,
that's why Manchester United, their every FA Cup match is shown live on TV almost without exception over recent years, and because they're the teams that get the viewing figures in. So it may not necessarily be the best game of the round. You know, that time ITV, I think, chose to show them playing Fulham, and it was sort of pretty obvious Fulham weren't going to be too up for it, and they duly got hammered, and there would have been any number of better games you could have shown.
Yeah, as Billy Bragg said so truly about romance, the chase is always better than the kill, and 'tis true of football as well. Now, going on this underwhelming weekend, the final point, if you like, to underscore it, Simon, Roberto Mancini, after what you can only describe as a routine win over Leeds United, said he's been the best manager in the Premier League over the last 18 months. Discuss.
Well, managers do have a habit of saying really things that will just make them look silly. It may be that Mancini is the best manager in Britain, but certainly he's the wrong man to say so. But, yeah, they scored an absolutely wonderful first goal that I could see on repeat for a long time. And for his part in that, I thank him.
Yeah, is that true, manager's DNA, that they have to occasionally or quite regularly say something silly, do you think, to be a top manager?
We all say silly things from time to time. I certainly do, anyway. I don't know if Mancini, you know, I'd certainly be of the opinion that self-praise is no praise, but I'd like to see how Mancini would do in charge of a club where he doesn't have a massive budget to buy new players and, you know, a club that hasn't had a £1 billion cash injection, you know, I'm sure we could all have a crack at managing a club like that. Put him in charge of Stockport County, see how he gets on.
Or indeed give him a go at Arsenal. Yeah. And we'll be talking with Raphael Honigstein about Champions League, Bayern and Arsenal very, very shortly.
This week on The Guardian Audio Edition, Tracy Thorn, the accidental pop star. Churches step in to fill the gap left by welfare cuts. And in the book review, we consider Frankenstein by Mary Shelley and Wendy Moore's How to Create the Perfect Wife. To subscribe for free to The Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
So we move on to Champions League, and they couldn't cope with Blackburn Rovers. Now they have to cope with Bayern Munich. It's surely an impossible task for Arsenal. To find out a bit more about Bayern, how they're playing at the moment, I think we know they're pretty good. We're joined by Raphael Honigstein. Hi, Raffy, how are you?
Hi, fine, how are you?
Yeah, not bad at all. I mean, Bayern have been sensational. We get that out of the way. Seven goals conceded is probably the most extraordinary statistic of all, isn't it? The next best, I think, in the league is Freiburg, who've conceded 22, but they haven't scored 57.
Yeah, they've been looking pretty ominous in the league, I think it's fair to say. I think it's a combination of things, really. One is the hunger after 2 years without winning the league, which is it's almost seen as a crime in Bavaria. Also the combination of, you know, Jupp Heynckes knowing that this is his last season, really determined to get things right, to leave on a high, leave with one or two trophies, and bringing in the likes of Javi Martinez and Mandzukic up front. It's just the overall depth in the squad is much better. He can rotate, he can keep everyone on their toes, and that kind of internal pressure combined with the external pressure of winning things has proved a very, very useful combination.
One of the interesting things about Bayern is they used to be, well, in recent years anyway, they've been fun, haven't they? I mean, you know, you watch a Bayern game, they're defensively a little bit naive, a little bit weak on occasion, and involved in a lot of high-scoring games. But that's not been the case this season. I mean, defensively so solid. Like, they've won five of the last eight games 2-0, and they just
It's really changed a lot this year. They haven't conceded a single goal in 2013 in five games, which is quite remarkable. And they always look good because they keep the ball, which of course makes it difficult for the opposition. But in the past, as you said, they were vulnerable on the counter-attack. And this was a bit of a legacy of the Van Gaal football, which was very, very dogmatic in terms of going forward at all times. And Heynckes is much more pragmatic. He's been able to build on the legacy of Van Gaal as far as their attacking football is concerned, but also brought in a very realistic, much more conservative approach when it comes to defending. And even a bit of pressing this year, which is another new factor that's come in, where they've taken a bit of a leaf from Dortmund. So all these things together make for a pretty useful strategy, especially if you consider that Bayern always have the best team in Germany, but sometimes they can be a little bit complacent, a little bit lackadaisical. But this year is very different because of what happened to them, both in the league but also in the Champions League.
Raphael, Barry here. Bayern, they've conceded seven goals in 21 games domestically, but they did concede seven goals in just six Champions League games. Is that, do you think, just because they're facing superior opposition, or is there another reason?
Yeah, it's difficult to explain. I'm not sure Bata Borisov are a superior opposition to sort of the regulars they face in the league, but they conceded three in Belorussia alone. So I think you have to put it down as a blip. I think it's probably a much better reflection to see what they've been doing in the league. But at the same time, I think it should give Arsenal a bit of hope, because they are not invincible, they're not impenetrable, they're not invulnerable. And if you think about in your mind about Theo Walcott running with pace at Daniel van Buyten, who'll have to play because Jerome Boateng is suspended, then I don't see any reason why they can't cause him a few problems, at least not on the first leg.
Paul, just to bring you in, I mean, how many times have we seen Arsenal bang their head against a brick wall? You know, they're meant to play this lovely flowing football, but they often play it in front of teams, don't they? And that's what happened against Blackburn. They miss chances. But given the way that Bayern play and given the stats, it doesn't look good, does it?
No, and you don't imagine that they will get a lot of space in behind Bayern at the Emirates. And they just don't, Saturday was just another case in point, they just don't have enough authoritative finishers in the team. Like, Walcott is probably their best finisher. And, you know, he's gone back to playing out wide. And he also likes to still, you know, run in behind people. So I wonder, Van Buyten, he's a strong player and he will be able to stand up to the likes of Giroud.
Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting to find out. I mean, do you give Arsenal hope in hell, Rafi? Have they got a chance?
They've got a chance, but I think it'll really come down to having a very strong performance at home. They have to take, I think, a fairly comfortable lead back to Munich with them to have a realistic chance. And also, I think, you know, they're so vulnerable when it comes to getting behind, and when they're not quite on their game, then they can look very, very poor. They're very temperamental in that sense. And I think if Bayern have watched recent games and realised this and maybe go for the killer early on and try to get that first goal and maybe score it, then you would fear for Arsenal a little bit.
We move on to Schalke. Jens Keller is the coach. And at the weekend, of course, they play Galatasaray in the Champions League. But there was this rather strange thing. They decided to play the Barcelona way against Mainz, a strikerless system. And I saw a quote flying around. The sporting director said, it works for them. Why can't it work for us? I mean, the obvious answer would be, you haven't got the same players. They drew two all, didn't they? Did it work?
Well, it worked in terms of halting, which was a terrible run of results. At least they got a draw at a very tricky place. I mean, Mainz are very, very tough to play against. And also, to be fair to him, they had the both regular number nines out. So he didn't really have that many other options. It worked okay because Michel Bastos, who's a new recruit from Lyon, had a very good game, scored two goals, and he's also sort of the main provider of hope when it comes to the Galatasaray game. It's remarkable what's happened since the draw, because when it was made, Schalke were kind of almost triumphant, you know, saying, punching the air, we've got Galatasaray, here we go. And now, with Drogba and Schneider arriving there and Schalke winning only one of the last out of the last 11, it looks a little bit different, and they think, you know, hopefully we won't get battered there in Istanbul. So it's an interesting one. It's a bit of a shame because the Schalke side that will turn up in Istanbul bears almost no relation to the one that did so well against Arsenal and other teams in the group stages, and you just wonder why they can't find the stability to really become the third power in German football, because the stature of the club actually warrants that. It's just on the pitch, they can't ever seem to get it right for too long.
And huge names being linked with the job when Keller, you know, he's only interim, he's a Rafa, isn't he, at Schalke, including Roberto Di Matteo has been linked with the Schalke job. Martin Jol as well, I've seen.
Yeah, they sounded them out, but the latest sort of leading contender is actually a real shock. It's Jupp Heynckes. In today's papers, and there is a chance that he might actually take the job. He's of course out of the job with Pep coming in. He's not happy at all, despite what you read about the way Bayern have handled this. And if he doesn't sort of go on a real high and winning a treble or something close to that, he might actually fancy one more go at Schalke, where he has sort of unfinished business because he was there and was a complete failure. Under Rudi Assauer, who's the sort of the boss there. He's gone now, and if he were to come back and have some sort of success, it would be the last thing to tick off on his CV. But it's all very preliminary, and for very obvious reasons, they can't really have a serious debate and serious discussions right now, but it's definitely one to watch.
When you said a surprise, I thought you were going to say Steve McLaren for a second there, but Heike's potentially there. Thanks for your time, Rafi, and enjoy the games this weekend.
Pleasure.
And incidentally, Didier Drogba did score his first Galatasaray goal in a 2-1 win against Akhisar, which I have to say is a new one on me, at the weekend. But Burak Yilmaz as well, who's been their star man, scored two. Talking of Didier Drogba, we talk Europa League, which everyone's been desperately waiting for, Simon. Chelsea with a 1-0 lead against Sparta and should go through. But do they still miss Drogba, do you think?
Sure. The idea was that Torres would, in his absence this year, flourish, and that hasn't happened. Barr has made a good first impression, but Drogba was, on his day, a phenomenon, and it's impossible for a team not to miss that.
Interestingly, Chelsea do have a Drogba heir apparent, and he's currently playing for West Brom and playing very well, but thing, Romelu Lukaku is who I'm talking about, obviously, but he's intimated that he wants to stay at West Brom for another season, and considering his age and how good he looks, he's shaping up to be as good, if not better, than Drogba.
Yeah, his is the name that certainly springs instantly to mind, isn't it, Lukaku. There's a general thing, but do you care about the Europa League? I mean, is it something that people, we have to pretend to care, but do you really care?
Well, I think it works for the football hipster, doesn't it? And you get to see him, and last season, Bilbao, all the athletics were a great experience for anybody tuning in. And sometimes you can, you know, I think Kharkiv against Newcastle is an interesting, you get to see the kind of the rising tide of Eastern European football now as well. So you get to see new faces, new names, and the stars of tomorrow. But you're not, I think it doesn't matter in the same way that a Champions League time matters.
Do football hipsters go to raves in Peru?
Football hipsters would go to raves in Peru if they got invited, but they don't because they're too busy trying to find dodgy streams of third division Ukrainian football.
And indeed, if they existed.
Would Nobby Solano be on the decks? That would make all the difference,
I would say. Or Teofilo Cubillas, maybe.
Yeah, Nobby Solano is far too well-known Peruvian, isn't he? But he's the only one I could think of off the top
of the football
head.
Hipster would say Teofilo Cubillas, but there you go. Elsewhere in the Europa League...
Sorry, if I could just go back to the Galatasaray Schalke game. I know you're fond of a bet, Dave, and have written a book about your fondness for a bet. But amazingly, Schalke are odds-on favourites to go through from that tie. And going on current form, there's absolutely no reason why that should be. I think Galatasaray are a sensational bet, at better than even money.
Yeah, well, no, Schalke certainly LA. And thanks very much indeed for the book plug, which will doubtless be edited out, but it's called The Perfect Punter and is available. There's loads left from various bookshops, certainly.
You made that joke last night.
Sorry?
You made that joke last night. Very funny.
I did make that joke on it about someone else's book, Gabriel Marcotti's book, yeah. So thanks for pointing that out. I try and use my jokes twice and then they're finished. Liverpool against Zenit's interesting. Brendan Rodgers, someone's going to have to explain this. Simon, maybe you're the man. They lose 2-0 away from home, and Brendan Rodgers describes it as a near on perfect performance.
Yeah, I think that people can get a bit too hung up about results. Admittedly, managers are perhaps the person who should get hung up. About results more than anyone else, but it was basically a very good display. It was, and they missed a hatful of chances, as they're prone to do, and had they scored a couple of those before Hulk's second half screamer, then and come away with, say, a 2-1 win or a 2-2 draw, it would have been an excellent evening's work, and they produced the performance that would have bought them that. And so, judging purely by the performance. By the team performance, it was not a disgraceful display, but and perhaps what tell your team in the dressing room that they played really well and were lucky to lose 2-0. But to then like Mancini saying that he's the best manager in Britain, for Brendan Rodgers to come out after 2-0 defeat and say it was the perfect away display is just inviting mockery, and he should know better.
So we've got goals are overrated, results are overrated. It's just we're just left with performance now.
Yeah.
Shirts. Nice kit.
No, they're overrated, I'd say.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, no, you football hipsters, you. Everyone, it's all about performance. It's about the beauty and nothing else. Is that true, Barry? It's nonsense, isn't it?
Speaking of performance and beauty, I'm reliably informed that Kevin Kilbane is a regular listener to this podcast. Mm-hmm. When he's currently out training for the marathon, which he's running for a Down syndrome charity, I think. So it's a very worthy cause. So, I'd just like to, you know, keep running, Kevin. Go a little bit faster and all that. And, the very best of luck to him. He's, I think, zoomed to the top of our celebrity listener list.
And talking of Kevin Kilbane performance, is there not a famous YouTube clip of him performing a particular song?
Yeah, I don't think he likes to talk about it anymore.
Okay. We just lost the listener. Paul, you have something, Kevin, to say?
No, I just wanted to go back to the Liverpool thing, because it is consistency that Liverpool need. And, you know, consistency of results, certainly. But if consistent performances are delivered, that's going to be the sort of thing that's going to allow them to bridge the gap to that top four.
It sort of went unnoticed, but they did win 5-0 at the weekend against... doubtless under-strength Swansea side, and that will be much talked about. But that's one of the results of his reign, isn't it?
It was very much Swansea's second string. But it looked a lovely performance from watching the kind of remedial match of the day too last night. It looked a really super performance. And Stuart Downing produced a couple of really wonderful moments. I've not been a fan of his at all throughout his career, but the pass for Suarez's goal was a proper eye-of-the-needle stuff.
Okay, well, good stuff from Liverpool. We should mention Spurs are through, aren't they? They're winning, or is that going to be tricky for them?
I mean, that's an away goal, though, isn't it? And again, they had to rely on two absolutely worldy free kicks from a worldy player. I don't know. I still think that Spurs are a lot more reliable this season. I think they will go through. But Lyon are going well in the French league.
Yeah, big win for Lyon at the weekend. Of course, with Paris Saint-Germain losing as well, a huge 4-0 win for Lyon. And do we say anything about Metalist against Newcastle? The sort of all quite uninspiring stuff. Would you fancy Metalist to go through something? Does anyone care?
Are the fans known as Metalists?
No, it's a question I've asked, and it's not a joke that they get. Anyway, moving on, we'll be talking to Sid Lowe in Spain coming up very, very shortly here on Football Weekly, which is the show for the football hipster. Right, so we move on to Spain. There's more Champions League chat. Can Milan do anything against Barcelona? Unlikely. But to talk Barca and a strange performance from them, and Real and Pellegrini and Atletico Madrid as well, Sid Lowe joins us on the line. Hi, Sid.
Hi, Hayden.
Yeah, now, just before we go on, I know this was something we talked about last week and James mentioned last week, but you got through the A's on your music collection and you were listening to a little bit of Aha, I think you got Take On Me.
I should defend myself and say I wasn't listening to Aha.
You've got Aha. You do listen to Aha.
No, I don't. I think it's just one of those many, many things that's in there that probably doesn't ever actually get listened to.
Okay, that's fine. What about the Bees then? I may have given you too much credit. I went Bauhaus and the Blue Nile, but is it a little more sort of prosaic than that?
Yeah, I would never claim to be a particularly a particularly cutting edge music fan. I've got some the band in there, the Last Waltz, which is a great album. It's very, very old. There's some Beatles in there. There's some Beautiful South, and suspiciously there's a Belinda Carlisle track as well.
That is where we're going to...
Apparently, heaven is a place on Earth.
Yeah, we're going to leave it very much there.
There really isn't a place on Earth called heaven, by the way.
Is there? Is it in Peru?
There must be. Somewhere.
It's a nightclub.
Yeah, nightclub.
Yeah, do nightclubs really count? I mean, a place.
There is a place called heaven.
I don't know, is there?
Okay, right.
There must be somewhere.
Okay, answering
the big questions this week.
It's the title of a terrible movie somewhere down the line. There's a place
I'd
called
be very
Heaven.
Disappointed if that Belinda Carlisle was so literal. If she had literally gone to somewhere called Heaven and written a song.
It'd be quite good though, because the whole song she could be giving you the map coordinates and stuff like that.
Listen, she was taken to heaven in sexual congress with a man. That is why heaven is a place on Earth.
Is that what that song's about?
Can we all
about?
Just get over it?
I used to have a big crush on Belinda Carlisle.
Did you?
Yeah, back when she was in that punk band.
Go-Go's?
Yeah, the Go-Go's.
It's intriguing. Absolutely
anyway,
intriguing.
Spanish football.
As the minutes tick. Sid, Barcelona, sort of slightly awkward win, wasn't it? They were losing at Granada, and then you know who saved them. But are they sort of getting away with it a bit at the moment?
Yeah, I think they are. And I think if they carry on the way they're playing domestically, they won't win the Champions League. But, of course, there's a whole series, there's a whole series of caveats to that statement. They're making really simple mistakes. They're conceding goals out of absolutely nothing. I mean, it feels like you don't even have to try very hard to score against Barcelona these days. And I hope this stat isn't wrong. I think it's 8 games in a row they've conceded now. Now, of course, the caveat is that partly that's about kind of the competitive edge, the focus and so on, and perhaps in European competition they'll be better. But they're making really silly mistakes time and time again. They did rest both Xavi and Iniesta this weekend, which of course makes a difference as well. And the other question is at the other end of the pitch, where I think they're actually a little bit over Messi reliant in terms of who gets the goals. And Alexis is... Alexis is so bad that you kind of feel sorry for him at the moment, and yet at the same time it's also kind of funny. Now, obviously, there are lots of people who would argue this, and I would give them, I would say they're right at times that his movement opens spaces for other people and so on. But he looks lacking in confidence. He doesn't look quick. He can't finish, and it's Barcelona have actually got, I think, a bit of a problem on their hands there.
Yeah, it was an interesting story, wasn't it, a couple of weeks ago? Barry Hunter, who scouted Alexis for Man City, but he ended up not going there, followed him home to check what his personal life was like and followed him around Udine to see how he lived his life. But he's not living it very well on the football pitch at the moment. I mean, Barcelona aren't going to win the Champions League, in your opinion, or if they play like this, they're not going to.
But sort these things out. But, I mean, the thing is, of course, they have the talent, the time and the temperament to do that. It's difficult to judge this, and you never know for sure, but how much difference it may be making that Tito Villanova's not around. The coach, of course, is in New York for treatment. So So that may well be an additional problem. And, of course, they still think they're too good for Milan. I think most people in Catalonia believe that. And I think Barcelona, while they believe that, they wouldn't fall into the trap of just kind of waltzing their way through the game. So I think they can resolve it. They do need to resolve it, because if they don't, they won't win the Champions League.
And what about Real? Fairly comfortable win against Rayo Vallecano, but not without controversy. Ramos sent off after scoring for two bookings in 2 minutes. And a big row, didn't he, with Jose?
Well, not quite a big row, but he made a point, and it was even worse than two bookings in 2 minutes, by the way. 42 seconds between the first booking and the second. The first was for an absolutely nothing foul, which I can't believe was a booking. The second was the second yellow card was for a handball. 16th player this season to be sent off for a handball, by which I mean, of course, the 16th player whose second yellow card has been a handball. Referees get cards out far, far too quickly for handballs all across the board in Spain, and I think it's a genuine problem. After the game, he, I think, had a little dig at Mourinho. In midweek in the Champions League, Mourinho was talking about the Manchester United goal, and he said, you know, however much preparation you do, however much organisation you do, if there are individual errors, there's nothing you can do about that. Now, of course, that was very definitely pointing the finger at Sergio Ramos, but he didn't name him. And also, I would argue, why shouldn't he point the finger at a player who's made a mistake in a situation like that? Ramos came out last night and said, it's not in my education or my manner to single out people for criticism. And basically, he's saying that Mourinho guy doesn't have the education or the manners that I do. And I think it was a very, very pointed remark. Again, though, without actually naming the person he was pointing at.
Okay, I wanted to ask you as well about Pellegrini, who seems to have been linked with every job under the sun. He said in a news conference, didn't he, that he turned the Roma job down. He was offered the chance to replace Zeman and didn't take it. And all sorts of talk that he's already turned down the offer of a pre-contract with Man City and has another job already. This, of course, the Malaga coach.
Yeah, his agent said that he'd been at least approached, to what extent this counts as an offer, but he'd been approached by Chelsea. Of course, we all know that Chelsea, if Abramovich one morning wakes up and fancies someone else, well, then he wakes up and fancies someone else, and it doesn't necessarily get followed through. But certainly, it makes some sense. Manuel Pellegrini has been very clear about saying that he has concerns about Malaga, about the fact they're being forced to sell their best players at a time when most people are accepting Malaga's explanations, and that includes players and the local media. Pellegrini was critical when Cazorla went, he was critical when Monreal went, and I think he is very definitely looking for an exit, and obviously knowing that his position is stronger than it's been in previous years, because he's, you know, at the end of his time at Real Madrid, while the performances weren't bad except in the Copa del Rey where they were disastrous, I think his reputation maybe took a slight hit after that, but what he's done at Malaga has been fantastic, so he now knows he's in a good position to move on. He speaks really, really good English. He's very bright. He plays the kind of football that we're told, at least, Abramovich aspires to. So I think in that sense, it there's a certain degree of logic. And there's also that, that kind of, you shouldn't really enjoy it, but that kind of schadenfreude even of kind of wondering how Mourinho will feel if Pellegrini suddenly turn up at Chelsea, and even more so if he turn up at Chelsea and won something.
Yeah, no, that would be a fun little conversation to look in on, wouldn't it? Are Malaga going to beat Porto, do you think?
I'll be honest with you.
Go on.
My first reaction when the draw was made was that's not too bad for Malaga. But then you look at the fact that Malaga won the group and who they could have played against, and it may well be the hardest of all those possible games. They've been really, really good in Europe. They control games. They're not particularly creative, but they keep the ball really well. They protect themselves with possession in a way that Villarreal did when Pellegrini was there. And I think they've got a reasonable chance. But I say that with the obvious and very large caveat, which is that I don't know enough about Porto.
Okay, and just finally, we're Europa League crazy on this show, of course. Atleti, the holders, are in serious trouble. A, do they care about turning it round? And B, if they do, can they?
They do care about turning it round, and actually that's proven by the way that they blew it. 1-0 up, 94th minute. Against Ruben Kazan, and they send up Sergio Asenjo, the goalkeeper, to try and see if they can score from the corner. Now, of course, that tells you everything about a team that's desperate to not lose the game, that therefore wants to go through. It backfired. Ruben Kazan break away, Asenjo is out of goal, and they score the second. Now, of course, everybody slaughtered Cholo Simeone for doing that. Now, of course, if it had come off, we'd all be saying he was a genius, and we'd all be saying, oh, how brave he is. And I think that's one of the problems, that sometimes we make analyses based on what comes out rather than whether the decision itself was the right one. My question mark with it is that I can understand the desire not to lose that game, and you know, the 1-0 down, so you go up in the last minute, makes sense. But when you've got a second leg still to come, I'm not completely sure it does make that much sense. perhaps it was worth a try, but it backfired pretty spectacularly. And they do care, and I think they will go for it. Interestingly, someone who, a friend of mine who covers Atletico really closely, was talking to me about this yesterday, and he said that he thinks that there's been a slight change in the mentality. In the after 2-0, that there was a sense of Simeone thinking, well, it's gone now. But the way the fans have reacted, and the way that the what's always described as the entourage, the entourage around the club has reacted this week, has perhaps reinforced him. No, this really matters. Let's go for it. Let's go there and see if we can turn it around.
Sid, thanks for your time, and good luck with your continuing search for heaven. Under Charing Cross Station last time I didn't look. I'm going to look at my producer and see if we've got time for some championship chat, because he sort of tantalised us with this, because we've got Simon with us. It's going quite well for your club, isn't it?
It is still going quite well.
That's
for
Watford, by the way.
In the last couple of weeks, there's been a little bit of controversy about the way Watford have put their squad together after Ian Holloway got a bit upset about it. And I think with a little bit of justification, I think there's plenty of other ways of running clubs that he should be upset about first. Anyway, it has been done, the squad has been assembled that is pretty good. And on Saturday, they destroyed Birmingham City 4-0. Jack Butland was the man of the match. Things are looking pretty good. The only downside for Watford is that Hull and Cardiff are also looking excellent. There's a full fixture list on Tuesday, a couple of interesting games. Probably the most interesting game is Blackburn, who, like I say, are in form, just beat Arsenal, as everyone knows, heading to Hull, who look a really strong side, to be honest. It'd be interesting to see what happens there.
Of all these loanees, who's the best?
Well, Matej Vidra is the top scorer, and he is certainly a Premier League quality. Man of the match on Saturday, quite an interesting character, Ikechi Anya, who was born in Scotland, was raised in Oxford, and was thrown out of the youth system at Oxford, and went to Glenn Hoddle's Second Chance Academy in Spain, and got his second chance, and now he's inevitably on loan at Watford from Granada. And he looked very good at the weekend.
Oh, interesting. And obviously Alexis Sanchez may be on his way there soon, or had he stayed at Udinese anyway.
Well, it was quite interesting, given that Granada, who are the other team owned by the Pozzo family, were playing Barcelona, and the Pozzo project has been very much helped by Alexis Sanchez's move to Barcelona. And for a stage, Granada were beating Barcelona, and Alexis was looking terrible, and he was kind of winning twice for the Pozzos, but only for Messi to intervene.
Yeah, I don't know what you're suggesting there. Given the times we live in, it's not Italy, you know. Barry, hot on Watford's heels of Palace. Lots of people are already saying, and we're going to hear this cacophony build, that it'll be great to have Ian Holloway back in the Premier League. Is that so, do you think? You look forward to that?
Yeah, I mean, I saw Palace draw 0-0 with Bolton a few weeks ago. It was the coldest I've ever been at a football match, or in anywhere, I think. And that was probably the most remarkable thing about noteworthy thing about the afternoon. I've just thawed out from it, which is nice. But, yeah, I mean, football's an ongoing soap opera, and like any soap opera, the more interesting characters you have in it, the better. And Holloway is always good value for money, even if he does sort of come out with some nonsense sometimes. I think he seems like a thoroughly nice man, and the Premier League would be a better place with him in it, I suspect.
Yeah, whoop whoop for Ian Holloway. Agree with that, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, and it's more likely to be Ian Holloway than Neil Warnock, isn't it? At least with Holloway, you get some good football on the way.
They're both strong characters who are interesting in small doses, I find, Holloway and Warnock, although I think Warnock has become more lovable for a neutral over as his career has progressed. But I think that you can have too much of both of them. They tend to, certainly Ian Holloway, he comes up with his comedy lines in press conferences, and they're hilarious for a while, but occasionally you just want him to say something bland for a change.
Yeah, that's just about it for this Monday. I'm going to leave you all with a question, though. Firstly for you, Simon, are Watford going to do it? I hate to curse you, but are they going to do it, do you think, as we've got you?
I'm not going to curse myself. Certainly, Watford's form is excellent, and I think they've got a very good chance of coming second. But as a fan, I would love to see this incredibly strong squad have another go at the championship. I like to see Watford win. I like to see them win easily, and we've got a better chance of doing that if we don't go up. We've been promoted twice before and had our fingers burned.
And Barry, as clearly a betting man yourself, with a knowledge of odds anyway, we talked a lot about the Champions League. I know a few people have got this strange feeling that there might be an odd winner, you know, like a Porto year, if you like, from Mourinho's time. Would you go along with that? Or who would your winner of the Champions League be, do you think? I mean, Sid is seemingly pretty anti-Barcelona if they keep playing this way.
Well, a lot of people fancy Bayern Munich, I think. I actually think Arsenal might get a result against Bayern Munich tomorrow, possibly not over two legs, but I think they may beat them in the first leg. I don't know, Galatasaray possibly? But then I don't see any Turkish football, so I don't know how good they are.
Yeah, you're in the same boat as all of us, I think, with that, but we'll find out, won't we? And my final question is to you, Paul. Where's the next imaginary rave?
The next imaginary rave will be in my head, starting at 1900 GMT. Everyone's invited.
Fantastic. In a place called heaven, of course, although not literally. That's it for Monday, anyway.
One thing I picked up on a story today in Syria after Napoli's game yesterday. Marek Hamzic was driving home and got held up by three gun-wielding ne'er-do-wells riding a scooter who stole his watch from him. It's the second Rolex he's had stolen from him. And he joins fellow Napoli star Valen Bourami in having had a watch stolen. And Edison Cavani's wife, I was very disappointed to learn that Edison Cavani does in fact have a wife, because my love for him is well documented. But she's had a watch stolen as well. So people in Napoli clearly don't want their footballers knowing what time it is.
Yeah, you know the story about the previous Hamzic watch, though, don't you? Which is that it was just as he arrived at the club, it was stolen, and the word was put out that the watch had been stolen, and then a week later it appeared back at the training ground. It was returned by those in the know in the back streets of Naples. So he may well get this one back, we'll find
out. And at the time he said he was very upset to lose it because it was his favourite Rolex.
Other driving-related story of the weekend. Portsmouth played Carlisle and charged Carlisle £20 to park their bus. apparently a move forced upon them by administrators. It shows what a sorry past they've come to, I suppose.
Yeah, the second and slightly stranger mention of Carlisle on this show. I hope they wouldn't charge Belinda Carlisle to park her bus, and that's not a euphemism. I'll be back on Thursday with Football Weekly Extra. It's the same show, but it just has a different name, and that's the kind of imagination that you get here, folks. But my thanks to Barry, to Paul, and to Simon. Have a fun week, and we'll see you then. Bye-bye.